Number 032672, Linnell Harding against Jerry Stearns. Steele.
May it please the court. The central issue in this habeas case is whether the petitioner was prejudiced by defense counsel's completely unwarranted disclosure of his prior convictions and sentences. That disclosure clearly constituted ineffective assistance of counsel, but the Strickland test also requires that there be prejudice as a result. And with respect to prejudice, the operative question is whether the Illinois appellate court acted not just incorrectly, but unreasonably so, in finding that no fair-minded juror could have voted for acquittal, even if they had not known about the conviction. Now, this was a very hotly contested trial. The state's principal evidence was an eyewitness identification, but as Judge Kennelly found, that identification was suspect. The initial lineup was suppressed, and then the victim had multiple opportunities to observe the defendant in court before he was called upon to make an identification. So there is at least question with respect to the identification. The defense put on a vigorous defense. There were four witnesses supporting the defendant's alibi to which he testified. He identified the person he said actually committed the offense. So we had a trial that was in fact hotly contested, and this is the kind of case the jurors are called upon to make, well, I would call it not so much credibility as accuracy determinations. And we have the question about the state case on the one hand, we have the vigorous defense on the other hand, and then we have defense counsel throwing in completely unnecessarily the fact the defendant was convicted of armed robbery, which is what he was charged with. And it's really mind-boggling. And what this did is it took this close case and made it a foregone conclusion. And the jury, for example, I'm not saying the jury would have had to find the victim was lying. They simply could have found he was mistaken. But in any event, they were faced with these scales that had been tilted egregiously unfairly against the defendant.
Mr. Buell, on the evidentiary claim, you argued that Mr. Harding was denied his defense, but he still argued the defense, didn't he? I mean, using his own testimony,
yes,
that Jordan had loaned him the car, he still argued,
yes,
the point to the jury.
If the jury knew, they presented a picture of Arctic Jordan in the defense case, they had the victim retake the stand, they showed
right.
him a picture of Arctic Jordan, he said he'd never seen him. But the question here is not whether Mr. Jordan proved his innocence. The question here is whether a reasonable juror could have had a reasonable doubt about the prosecution's case. Because that, of course, is the state's burden in a criminal trial.
Does the Supreme Court's opinion in Baldwin change your presentment argument on the Jordan claim?
No, that has to do with oral argument, Judge. So I don't think it changes our analysis. And in fact, I think the case that supports us is this court's case from last week, which I filed yesterday, Harris versus Cotton, in which this court in fact found that the Indiana courts had unreasonably found that there was not prejudice. That case involved an error of omission, a failure to get a toxicology report, as opposed to an error of commission, the disclosure of the his prior convictions. But I would submit the errors were of similar magnitude, and that case should provide an analogy, a compelling analogy, in terms of meeting the standard of an unreasonable error by the state appellate court.
What? Help me with this. How would you articulate the unreasonableness that the court...
Yeah, the unreasonableness, actually, the question is, his convictions really weren't significant evidence. So the question really is just taking the actual evidence, was it a close enough case that a reasonable juror could have acquitted? Not that a reasonable juror would have had to have acquitted, but we're not arguing the judge should have granted a directed verdict. But was the evidence with the tainted identification and the vigorous defense close enough that absent the prejudice that the jury in unavoidably was brought upon them by the disclosure of these convictions, without that, could a reasonable juror have voted for acquittal? And in terms of that analysis, the disclosure of the prior convictions really is irrelevant. It's sort of without that, just weighing the both sides, could a juror have voted to acquit? And I submit that this is a close enough case that a reasonable juror could have voted to acquit.
So it's the adding the additional weight of the three conviction prior convictions that
that's what makes it unfair to the I think it it's so clear, and I've cited cases that talk about this, that works that works to cause jurors to be more likely to convict. That there's Wigmore and the other cases that I cite. So that's the ineffective assistance. Actually, this is the analysis. The ineffective assistance is the disclosure of the conviction. The prejudice is that the case was so close it could have gone either way. So I would submit essentially that Petitioner Harding did not receive a fair trial. One is not entitled to a perfect trial, but one is entitled to a fair trial. And I submit that he did not receive a fair trial. And I would ask this court to reverse Judge Kennelly, who found there was error, but got hung up on the unreasonable standard that the Supreme Court has imposed. And I would ask the court to direct that a writ issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Mr. Iskowich.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mr. Beal, may it please the Court. My name is David Iskowich. I'm with the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of the respondent. As is to be expected, Mr. Beal and I disagree about the scope of the prejudice analysis.
You're a tough guy. The district court agreed with you, and you tear them apart in your brief.
Your Honor, I have to, when I come into this court, I have to make sure I cover all my bases.
I mean, really, when you get down to it, what is a district judge to do when a state appellate court talks up its sleeve? And you can't tell exactly what the basis of the decision is, it's pretty tough.
Is Your Honor speaking of the
appellate
court?
That's where you disagreed with the district court.
My disagreement with the district court is with its analysis of Strickland's first prong, the performance prong. I think that a fair reading of the appellate court's opinion shows that it found trial counsel's decision in this instance to be one of strategy, because this case came about hinged on credibility, truthfulness.
You know, I can understand how it may have been strategic to raise prior convictions. It's a stretch, but it's still conceivably reasonable. But what I cannot possibly understand is what it added to the strategy to reveal the actual offenses of conviction and the term served. Can you try and explain how those additional facts can be anything other than an enormous mistake?
Your Honor, I can't come in here. I supplied the transcript portion of that exchange. I can't come in here and say that counsel did that intentionally and that it wasn't an oversight or misstatement or dropping the ball on his part. The transcript clearly shows that when he brought up the armed robbery, he realized right away he screwed up. He immediately asked the trial court to strike it, and he asked that the jury be instructed to disregard it. He did that. What I can say is that the overall strategy of showing to this jury that this defendant might not be the nicest guy, but in this case in particular, he didn't do it, and we're going to come clean with his record. That was strategy. Now, I can't come in here, as I said, and say that his revealing of those nuances about these convictions was. I can't in good faith come in here and say that. But the trial transcript is very clear. Counsel knew that he screwed up. He asked the trial court immediately for an instruction. He asked the trial court immediately to strike the comment, and it was stricken. And this court had held in the context of a prejudice analysis, if I might just skip ahead, that a jury instructed accordingly is presumed to have followed the trial court's instructions. That's how our system works. And I, if that answers Your Honor's question sufficiently, I'd rest there.
Wasn't the purpose of introducing it, though, apparently, to show that that's why he gave a false name?
That's true, Your Honor. He had, according to Mr. Harding, had prior dealings with the police, which he claimed were not pleasant encounters with the police.
But how does, this goes to Judge Rovner, so how does showing that you have prior convictions indicate that you have a concern that you're going to be mistreated by the police?
Well, the mistreatment by police was the precursor question to this exchange. He was attempting to show not the truthfulness of Mr. Harding's overall demeanor in court, and I believe that the police connection comes insofar as he did have prior dealings with police, and they weren't, the prior dealings with police were not pleasant ones.
Well, but that, and the convictions don't necessarily show that. There may be other things that show that he had unpleasant run-ins with the police, but just the fact of conviction doesn't show that.
Again, Your Honor, the transcript here shows that counsel did proceed on a course which perhaps in hindsight was ill-advised. I can't deny that. We're dealing with a cold record here. Unfortunately, this is the transcript I'm left to deal with 13 years later. In light of, I don't want to be cliche here, but in light of the AEDPA and the deference owed to state court applications of federal law, it's virtually impossible for petitioner to overcome not only performance, and if the court's dubious about the performance prong here, I would completely understand. I can't stand up here and disagree with you, although I will defend it. On prejudice, however, I'm sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
I was just going to say on prejudice, we have an eyewitness identification in court. Mr. Harding does not challenge that in federal habeas. He does not challenge the appellate court's application of Manson versus Braithwaite to the relevant facts. He does not challenge the facts themselves. He does not challenge the in-court identification. So what we're left with here is an in-court identification. The victim testified he had 30 seconds within which to view the victim, I'm sorry, the perpetrator, Mr. Harding, head-on. Mr. Harding yanked his chain off his neck.
I want to forgive me, I want to go back to the position that you took in your brief that Mr. Harding acquiesced in his attorney's questioning, because I think that's a very extreme position to take, Mr. Iskowich.
I understand.
What should Harding have done on the stand?
I understand, Your Honor.
When his attorney started asking him these questions, because what you've done here is you've placed on a defendant the burden of knowing in the middle of the trial that his attorney is incompetent.
That was the concern of the district court. There is a line of Illinois cases which should suggest that a client's acquiescence in a certain course of conduct can constitute a waiver. Now, our office is in this court a lot, and we've gotten in trouble before by not raising waivers. And my job here is to raise every possible defense to this criminal court judgment. I haven't addressed
it
in my
role. Yeah, but not those that are frivolous or bizarre.
I wouldn't characterize it as frivolous or bizarre, Your Honor.
Oh.
I would characterize it as a stretch. Of course, I'm being very frank here. But we are bound to raise every possible procedural bar we can. We've gotten in trouble for not doing so.
We've gotten in trouble for doing so, too, of late.
Could we return to the question, sir, that I asked originally?
Of course, Your Honor.
What, in your view, what should a district court do when faced with an ambiguous statement by an appellate court, appellate state court, in the habeas situation? I mean, where does the presumption lie? I mean, we have cases like Michigan against Long and in other but analogous situations that say, well, if you can't tell whether it's a state or federal holding, presume it's a federal holding and go ahead. Should we do the same thing here? Does the tie, in other words, go to the petitioner?
Well, I First of all, as I said, Your Honor, I don't know if this appellate court decision is all that ambiguous.
I understand, but let's play my game for a
hypothetically,
minute. Let's say that you lose on that one.
Okay. Hypothetically, in an ambiguous appellate court holding, state courts are presumed to know and follow federal law. I think that in the advent of the AEDPA, we must presume that if, and I think this goes to a way of solving this problem, perhaps, is going to the Rule 5 exhibits and the petitioner's brief. If the petitioner sets forth an argument in his brief which entails and discusses federal law and applies that law to the facts, and then the state court's discussion of the same, while perhaps ambiguous, also discusses the facts, and maybe they don't cite the relevant law, I think the presumption has to be, under the AEDPA, state court acting on that brief applied federal law to the facts. Therefore, I would say that in this case, if the court has any doubts about any ambiguity in the appellate court's opinion, we must look to the appellant's brief, which discussed Strickland in this framework and attempted to apply the Strickland framework to the relevant facts. And my position is the appellate court did so here, and that would clear up any confusion and require AEDPA analysis. I thank you, Your Honors, and thank
you, Your Honor. Can I ask you one more question?
Yes, of course, sure, Your Honor.
I'm looking back at the case that your opponent submitted yesterday, and we find that there's a reasonable probability the outcome of the proceeding would have been different if toxicology results were presented. Is there a reasonable probability that but for the introduction of those prior convictions, the outcome would have been different?
Our position is there's not here, Your Honor, and that the appellate court's holding so was reasonable. We not only have the corrected or stricken statement from the defense attorney's discussion with his client during the course of the redirect examination, but we also have the evidence of an in-court identification, as well as the fact that the petitioner was found in possession of the victim's car a week later, claimed that it was his car, and after a search of that car, it was discovered that the victim's, I believe it was his registration papers and insurance papers, were inside that car. I think any fair-minded juror, as the appellate court said in this case, would not have voted to acquit, but for counsel's error. I thank the court for its time and respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's opinion.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You have 3 minutes, Mr. Beal.
Just briefly, I'd like to clarify a couple of points. Judge Rodner, with respect to Baldwin, it may in fact have some bearing on our second argument, but I submit that it has no bearing on our first argument. And with respect to Mr. Iskowich's argument, first of all, with respect to the identification, we don't concede the identification was a good identification. We're simply not arguing that it's constitutionally infirm for habeas purposes. I mean, remember how the lineup took place, and they had the two short defendants in a lineup with four tall people. The victim identified it. Then to take the lineup picture that they tried to foist in the court, they had them sit down so they all looked like they were the same height. And the judge threw that out. But by that point, the victim had made an identification. And he then sees the defendant several times in court, and there's a lot of pressure on him. I'm not saying anyone was doing anything illegal, but there was a lot of pressure on him to stick with his identification. So we do not concede that that it was a good identification. And secondly, with respect to the statement that he owned the car, we have very little evidence as to what actually happened. I mean, it could have been the cop came up and said, "Is this your car?" And he said, "Yes," because he was driving it. We don't have any indication he said, "I'm the owner of this car." So that's also not clear, strong, and convincing evidence. So I would submit under the totality of the situation, this case is indeed analogous to the Harris versus Cotton situation, and I would ask this court to direct that a writ issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Beal. Mr. Beal, you served us by appointment to the court. We have our deep thanks for your fine job today on behalf of your client. Thank you, Mr. Iskowich, as well. And this case will be taken under advisement.